I'm Will Howell.
I'm Viola Giuda.
I'm Anthony Fowler, and this is Not Another Politics Podcast. My mom has been calling me regularly to find out what I think about the Democratic Convention. And she's surprised that as political scientists, we're not glued to our television nonstop following. What do you guys think? Any thoughts?
What are you saying? We are glued to our television
nonstop. I can't get enough.
What do you think I do?
I have a thought.
Just cable news 24/7. Yeah.
I think it's good. When the alternative is, you know, like balloon drops in convention halls, that's not good TV.
When you do turn on the you know, the cable news, as we do every day as political scientists, we see a lot of men. We see a lot of male politicians. About 3 in 4 members of Congress are men. Every president and every vice president in history has been male, but half the population is female. So something seems amiss. Something seems amiss in the sense that half the population is female, but not half of the politicians are female. A female has been nominated to run for vice president, which is, I think, exciting news for a lot of people who really like Kamala Harris, and we'll get back to her in a minute. But what do we think about this underrepresentation of women in the political process? And do we have a whole lot of empirical evidence that speaks to that, as to why we have that?
Yeah, so, you know, if you were cynical, the simplest explanation for why there are so few women in politics would be women are just not good at politics. So I talked to our colleague, Chris Berry, who has this paper with Sara Anzia, where they say, okay, let's just see, is there any truth to this very simplistic explanation? And they look at women in Congress, and they find women in Congress perform better, and I'm going to say much better, we are going to go into numbers later, they perform much better than men on average.
So let's give the interview a listen.
So Chris, you have a paper with Sara Anzia, who is a professor of political science at Berkeley, in which you are trying to tackle this question, shed some light on this question, why do we have so few women in politics? Before you even ask this question and answer this question, you sort of ask an auxiliary question. You say, let's look at the women who are in Congress and let's see how they do. Do they perform better than men? Can you tell me a little bit more about how you measure performance of women in Congress and what you find?
In our paper, we use 2 metrics of performance, which are meant to capture what we think of as the 2 main facets of a legislator's job, which are bringing home goodies for the district, for the constituents, or what's broadly called constituent service, and then also legislating or policymaking. And so for the first of those, we look at federal project spending that comes to the district during the time of the legislator's term. For the second, we look at bill sponsorship and co-sponsorship patterns.
And what do you find?
We find that women perform better on both of these metrics. So a district receives roughly 10% more federal project allocations during the time when a woman is representing it than a man. And women sponsor significantly more bills than men. They also co-sponsor more bills, and they garner more co-sponsors on their own bills than men do. And interestingly, they also co-sponsor with a wider network of other co-sponsors on their own bills.
So let's talk about possible explanations. My favorite explanation, the first one that comes to my mind, of course, is women are better than men. As far as I remember, that's not the explanation that you suggest in your paper. So can you tell me a little bit about your explanation and why you think that's the right explanation?
Sure. I mean, we suggest that women are better because of the process by which women are selected into politics in the first place. Because there's discrimination in politics, because there is the voters discriminate against women, the women who win office have to be better than the men that they ran against. And this is why the paper is titled The Jackie and Jill Robinson Effect. We are obviously making an analogy to Jackie Robinson, the first African-American player in Major League Baseball. And part of the story there was he had to be so much better than sort of the next best white player in order for owners and fans and other players to have accepted him into baseball in the first place. And we're making a similar argument about women in politics. There's a second explanation, more of a psychological explanation, and this is associated with Jen Lawless, who's one of the leading scholars of women in politics. And she suggests what she calls a perception gap between men and women, which is just that women underestimate their own qualifications for office. And she has reached this conclusion through surveys that she's done where she asked them if they've ever thought of running for office before or whether they believe they're qualified or not. And women of the same objective qualification systematically consider themselves to be less qualified than men do. That would be another mechanism that would make the women who get elected of higher quality. That is, if women systematically underestimate their qualifications, then those that do run are going to be more qualified, and those that get elected will be of higher quality. In our paper, we don't take a position on these two particular mechanisms, but we do suggest that either one of them would result in the kind of findings that we get.
But you have some additional evidence that I think speaks to which of these two phenomena occur, or which one is more likely, or that they both occur. So the first one is, you ask a question on whether women perform better if they are elected in districts in which we would expect ex ante higher degree of gender discrimination. Can you talk to me about this a little bit?
Yes, and I should say, I mean, you're forcing me to put my cards on the table, which is great, and I should. I personally lean towards the interpretation that discrimination is the more powerful mechanism here. One of the things we do is we have another measure of voter discrimination that we use, which is just kind of the conservativeness of the district. And we find that women who come from these more conservative districts perform even better. In other words, there's a correlation in the performance of women and the conservativeness of the district, where the more conservative the district was that the woman was elected from, the even better that she performs. And that's certainly a prediction of the discrimination mechanism that we talk about. Now, I think one could say that if you really believe that there's this kind of psychological mechanism going on where women underestimate their own qualifications, then you might argue that women who are coming from these more conservative districts are more subject to that kind of a psychological mechanism internally. Maybe they've been raised in an environment that's more conservative, telling them that women are less qualified. And so maybe that mechanism is also stronger in districts that are more conservative. I happen to kind of lean with you on this particular one, that this seems like very clear evidence that the discrimination mechanism is at work. But it could be interpreted as being consistent with the self-selection on quality mechanism too.
Okay, fair enough. So I see how this is sort of a support of the joint story that you're proposing, but it's
yes,
hard to use this piece of evidence to differentiate between those two. What about a different thing that you do in the paper, which is you look at women who became congresswomen because they succeeded their husbands in Congress, and you compare them to women who just became elected in a competitive process, and you find something interesting there. So can you walk me through that?
Sure. I mean, it is true that for particularly in the early years of women's emergence in politics and in Congress, a very large proportion of the women that were elected to Congress were elected to succeed their husbands who had occupied the seat and died in office. And so often the widow would either be appointed or run for office and win. And so we look at the performance of those women, the women who are the widows of congressmen, and ask whether they perform as well. And we find that they do not. And the logic there, we think, is that those women didn't have to overcome the kind of discrimination that a new de novo female candidate would have to overcome in order to win office. And so we wouldn't, if it really is this discrimination mechanism that accounts for the difference in performance, we wouldn't expect to see that for widows. We don't find it for widows. And so that is another piece of evidence for the discrimination mechanism. Again, if I were going to play devil's advocate, I would point out that you might think also that widows are less subject to the psychological mechanism that leads them to underestimate their own qualifications. And so you could tell a story where that's also consistent with that mechanism again.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about alternative explanations. So let's try to put ourselves in the shoes of someone who doesn't really buy your finding that women actually perform better in Congress. So let me try a few things. So the first one is, of course, you're comparing women to men. Perhaps women just happen to be elected in districts which receive more money from the federal government. You know, I can tell many stories for why that would be. What if that's what you're seeing? They're just not better, they just happen to be in better districts.
I think that's the most obvious sort of alternative interpretation to our findings, is because it is true that women are not selected at random in districts, and women do represent districts that are different on average from the districts represented by men. So, for example, women are more likely to come from districts that are more urban, have a higher poverty rate, have different racial composition on average than the districts that elect men. And so you might think, That's the reason why those districts are getting more money, not because of the person they elected, but because of features of the district that just make them more eligible to attract federal money. That's why our research design is based on a, let's just say, a within-district analysis, where our comparisons are really coming from the same district that has been at different years represented by a man versus a woman, and we compare the amount of money flowing to that district in the years represented by a woman versus a man. That way, because it's within the same district, it can't be the fact that, that women represent different kinds of districts that would explain these results, because really here we're just talking about how much money does the same district get in years when it has a woman versus a man in office, and we restrict those comparisons to within the course of a decade. So it's also not the case that the district could have changed radically between the time it had elected a man versus a woman. These are relatively small blocks of time over which we're making these comparisons.
Is it true that the majority of women who are in Congress are coming from the Democratic Party?
Absolutely. And there have certainly been years during which virtually all the women in Congress are Democrats. That's changing a little bit. We're starting to see some emergence of more female Republican candidates, though still a huge majority of them are Democrats. And so that might be another concern that you would have with this kind of results, which is if, you know, in an extreme example, if all Republicans were men and all Democrats were women, then the change from a man to a woman would also imply a change in party. And you might think that Democrats, just due to that party's platform, are more likely to want to bring home, for example, federal project spending, and more likely to want to pass legislation. And we can control for party, so we can look, again, when I'm talking about within district, we can look at a district that's represented in both of the periods by a Democrat, but one of those Democrats is a man and the other is a woman. And we still find these results. So I think that's another pretty obvious concern that people would have, knowing that that women are more likely to be Democrats.
So is there anything in particular that you think we haven't covered that you would like to mention? I went over most of my, I just have one more question, but like these were most of my, the issues I wanted to cover.
Yeah, I mean, I think one interesting thing, when the paper first came out, and one of the common misunderstandings that I think a lot of reporters had, that we were claiming that women are inherently better, kind of your first explanation that you led with, I think maybe jokingly, was that we had found that women are somehow inherently better.
I wasn't joking.
Men. Okay. but anyway, I had a number of reporters, you know, that said, ah, so what your paper is telling us is that we should all go out and vote for women because they're better and they're going to provide better representation for us. And in fact, you know, our prediction would be just the opposite of that. If everyone decided that women were better and went out to, like, in other words, developed a bias in favor of women, we would actually expect their quality advantage to go away. Because in our account, women are better precisely because they had to overcome discrimination. And so if that discrimination were to go away or to be reversed so that people favored women, we would get exactly the opposite prediction. And so in a kind of perverse way, one of the marks of the success of women in politics will be when our finding goes away, when it's no longer the case that the women when it's no longer the case that the women elected to office perform better than men. That would actually be a sign that that things have become equal and they no longer had to overcome this kind of discrimination to begin with.
Terrific interview. I think we need to address three issues. The first is that we need to interrogate the particular explanations for why we see the effects that we see, why it is that women are performing better than men in Congress. Second, I think we should take some time to reflect upon Kamala Harris's selection as Biden's VP and what Anzia and Barry's findings have to say about this, the significance of Harris's selection. And third, let's take some time to reflect a little bit more generally about the relevance of discrimination as a political phenomenon in affecting different people's ability to perform better or worse, to think beyond simply issues involving sex and sex and race, to think more generally about how discrimination and selection bears upon performance.
So I think it's very important that we explain why they even started thinking about this explanation. So if you just look at their result, the first big empirical result that women perform better than men, the first obvious explanation that we should jump at is women are just better. So it's worth to point out that the reason why we are searching for some other explanation than this most straightforward one is that we have other pieces of evidence that they put forward in their paper that leads us to question this explanation as the most obvious one. So those two pieces of explanation is the first one that we mentioned at the beginning. There are so few women in politics. If they were so much better, then you would expect that there would be more of them. And the second piece of information is that if you take two incumbents, one male and one female, they actually, when they run, they are equally likely to win. So it seems to be that conditional on running for office, women are equally likely to be elected. So they just started to think, how can we reconcile those three pieces of information that we have into a coherent story? And the story of just women being better, you know, explains why women perform better in Congress, but doesn't explain why we have so few of them. And why isn't it the case that voters actually are more likely to elect a woman expecting that she will perform better?
Yeah, and some of the findings that they put forward are incompatible with this essentialist claim. So, for instance, the fact that women from particularly conservative regions of the country disproportionately do better, unless you believe that somehow in conservative parts of the country, the women are of sort of higher quality stock. I mean, why would we believe that? But what they do suggest is, no. But what we could see is that they're held to much higher standards, and that the discrimination against women is even greater in those domains. And so that the hurdle that they have to clear is even higher, which is then pointing towards this selection mechanism as being crucial. I think my favorite cut at the data is when they look at the widows of male legislators who, for a good portion of congressional history, would take over the seat of their husbands when they died. And what they find is that widows don't perform any better along the metrics that they offer. And again, if you had just a straight essentialist argument, you'd say, well, women are women, and so they should be performing higher, regardless of, you know, what their pathway was to securing the seat. But precisely because the pathway for a widow to reclaim the seat of a husband, the husband who dies, is smoother than it is for a woman running from the outside, it suggests that she doesn't face the kind of discrimination that many kinds of women do face, and that therefore we wouldn't expect her to be of higher quality. She doesn't have to clear that threshold, even though what you might say is that by virtue of being the spouse of a legislator, you're privy to all kinds of insider knowledge. You're given certain advantages that would directly bear upon your ability to do your job well. But the discrimination that they're talking about is in the background of the analysis, right? They don't go out and measure it directly. They don't have, you know, a score for each legislator that characterizes how much discrimination she, he faced, and then looks for heterogeneity in the effects as a function of that observed phenomenon. What they say is that, well, if you believe that women from conservative districts face higher levels of discrimination, or if you believe that widows face lower levels of discrimination, that has implications for the size of the effects that we ought to observe. And sure enough, it carries through in ways that makes sense. But they don't directly observe the discrimination. And I think it's something of an open question, too, about when we say discrimination, where is that discrimination? Is this a story about voters? Is it about voters who look more skeptically upon women who run for office? Is it a story about donors and their willingness to get behind women versus men? Or never mind their own individual views about the leadership qualities of men and women. Is it about sort of networks and structures that advantage men versus women? We don't know. I think there's an abundance of possibilities here, but none of this is pinned down for us.
Yeah, I think I would like to ponder over that a little bit more. So I like their story, but you know, the way we talk about it, it seems like there are these vicious voters, there are these biased voters, biased lobbies, that there's this sort of evil sort of thing that's preventing women from being elected to office. And it's possible that there is. But, you know, there's also a little bit more nuanced or like more innocent explanation, which is, for so many years, we've lived in a patriarchy, and as a result, it might be that we are all conditioned, men and women, everyone in the society is conditioned to think about women as less skilled given the same set of characteristics. So, you know, we look at a man and a woman with the same education and the same experience, and there's something in us that says, well, but she's a woman, so she probably is not as, and here you put your favorite adjective, as ambitious, as skilled, as a trailblazer, as a man would be. And it might be completely innocent. We are just bad at judging the quality of women because they behave differently. There are a lot of stories in psychology that, for example, when we see someone who is loud, who interrupts other people, we say, oh, this person is confident. This person must be actually good. And when we see someone a little bit more quiet, we say, this person is probably not skilled. They are probably not really competent. Even though, you know, the people might be actually as competent, or it might be in the reverse. There's a lot of evidence that we are all bad at judging women's quality, given the external characteristics. And that story is a little bit more innocent, and it could explain their data perfectly. When we see a woman running, we perceive her as worse, so we don't elect her so frequently. And women actually look at themselves and they say, well, you know, I'm not as high of a quality as my male colleagues, so I'm not going to run. And as a result, you see only the highest quality women, who cannot actually deny that they are so high quality, running for office. So the outcome is the same, but the story is a little bit more nuanced. It's not a story of sort of like the sinister discrimination. I don't like women. I don't want to have them around. I don't want to see them in politics. I'm not going to vote for them. It's more like, I would like to have a woman as much as I would like to have a man. It's just I look at this woman and she doesn't seem competent. So it seems to be this implicit bias as opposed to this explicit bias. But there's a second difference between what I'm saying and what they are saying, is that in their model, in their story, women judge themselves correctly. They realize how skilled they are, and they decide not to run because they recognize they will be discriminated against. In my story, when a woman decides not to run, the reason why she decides not to run is because she herself thinks she's not good enough to be a politician. And she doesn't believe she will be elected, not because she'll be discriminated against, but because she doesn't have enough of ability.
Yeah, and I guess this is where I want to underscore the kind of ambiguity about the phenomenon that we're describing, right? It seems to me you could have the discrimination work outside of any story about psychology or any story about the individual opposition of any individual to get behind a female candidate. It's that this sort of the networks of fundraising are built around men, or the networks of endorsements and personal connections are built around men. And that even if you had perfectly well-meaning men who occupy those positions of power, that leads to this kind of support, that provide the kind of support you need in order to succeed in a campaign, women to break into those structures need to be of higher quality. And that's what drives it.
Right. But it could be that a lot of women want to run and they go talk to some people and they try to get the signatures and they can't get them. They can't get the money. They can't get the endorsements. And we never hear about them because they had a failed campaign before they even appeared in any public database or anything like that.
Yeah, I think you're right that we should definitely think about networks and about what happens before a woman even shows up on a ticket. These are conversations that we have very frequently in academia because we have a similar problem. In many departments, in many fields, we have many fewer women than men. And there's this question, why is this the case? And yes, you can talk about explicit discrimination, but a lot of people recognize that networking is very important. You go for a beer with someone after a conference, you go golfing with someone, and you know, and then you start talking about
you were
research.
Invited to the golf outing, just to be clear.
Let's see how this all plays out. So yeah, so you know, like you start talking, and this maybe sounds sinister. It's like, okay, we are just forming connection, and that's why some people get promoted, but it's also less sinister. Like we start golfing and we start talking about research, and then you say, oh, actually I like your research, I think it would be a great addition to our department. So at least there's a lot of narrative in where we live, the world we occupy, that networks, the structure, the way we build this entire promotion machine in politics or in academia is discriminating against women completely, you know, without an intention, just as a byproduct of us living in the world of men for such a long time. I just want to say one more thing for all the women out there. You know, we started this conversation by saying that perhaps women are just better than men. That's why we see them performing better. And then we went through this entire story. We know that this cannot be the explanation for everything that we see in the data. But I think we have to be very clear that And nothing in what we've discussed so far and nothing in the data says that actually women are not better than men. That, you know, their story can be at work and it's possible at work. It's very plausible. But at the end of the day, we don't know what would happen if we removed selection and discrimination or any of the story that we put forward. You know, the question is still out there. We don't know what the difference between genders is.
That's right.
That's true. Although you wouldn't be spending so much time on this topic if they had found that men are better than women. We wouldn't be saying, well, maybe men really are better than women. So, I mean, there is some, I mean, I think this is actually kind of a tricky challenge in any kind of test of discrimination. There's results that are more politically desirable than others. Usually our first inclination isn't to think, oh, there must be some big biological difference that explains this phenomenon.
I'm not saying that's my default. I just want to put it out there that there's no piece of evidence so far put forward that there are no differences. And I completely agree with you that, especially as a researcher, we should start with the presumption of there are no differences and see what else is happening in the world. But I just wanted to put it forward, you know, especially because we have a VP that's female. And, you know, I would like to think the best thing about the future of this candidate and the future of this country.
So let's talk about Kamala Harris, and let's talk about what some of these different explanations might imply for the potential for a female vice president. Kamala Harris, if you buy this story, has, throughout her political career, faced a higher burden than a male candidate would have otherwise faced, right? If I just told you that someone was Attorney General of California and a U.S. Senator and had the following qualifications, when I also tell you that person is a female, and you've read and you've understood this Anzie and Barry story, you should say, oh, they must be especially high quality, not because they're a woman per se and there's biological differences between men and women, but because she must have faced higher hurdles along the way. And so she must be really, really competent, really smart, really, you know, ambitious, really outgoing, really creative, etc. She has got something going for her that makes voters support her despite the fact that she's a woman. Do we buy that story with Kamala Harris?
Well, I think there's this other dimension, right? Which is that what's significant about Kamala Harris is not just that she's a woman, she's a woman of color. And I think we need to have some kind of accounting of how race also can serve in all the ways we've just described as another source of discrimination, another kind of impediment to one's ability to get traction on a national level. And so then to the extent that race interacted with sex should lead us, if we believe the Anzia Berry story, to expect Kamala Harris to just be ready to kick some ass. There is this one piece, though, that I think complicates the story, which is that her parents are from Jamaica and India, so they're both immigrants. They both also, it's worth noting, have PhDs, but put that aside for the moment. They're both immigrants, right? So, I mean, the work that her race and immigrant status is doing is not just about erecting barriers. It may also be informing the character that she has and the qualities that she brings to bear and the ways that her parents raised her. And that those things, too, may be contributing to her success in important ways. It's not just in spite of her immigrant status that she's able to, you know, overcome barriers that are put before her, but because of it, that sort of imbued her with a strength of character.
It's a complicated story because if you think maybe on some dimensions she's disadvantaged, on other dimensions maybe she's very privileged, right? She did have two parents with PhDs, and not everybody has that. And so maybe some poor white man from Appalachia who had no economic or educational opportunities, they also would have to overcome a ton in order to one day become a U.S. senator. And the Anzia Berry story would apply to that person as well. And so in some dimensions, Kamala Harris is privileged. In some dimensions, she's underprivileged. And on net, how does that shake out for how we think of, you know, her ability? It's hard. It's a little bit hard to say.
I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, I don't want to get into kind of an essentialist argument. I don't want to do that, right? But I think it feels sort of like we've flattened out the phenomenon when all we say is that depending upon which set of boxes you check, you face higher or lower levels of discrimination. And the significance of those boxes is just about discrimination. But now I'm drifting into Viola Duda land and saying, maybe, women, this sounds a little bit like, well, women are better, right? Women are better, right? And that's that's problematic, or making an essentialist argument. So I guess I'm feeling,
uncomfortable making this argument.
I'm uncomfortable trying to sort out what the significance is of the ascriptive characteristic that we're identifying. And I want to say it's more than just the implications it has for discrimination and selection. It has, it's a much bigger significance than just that. Like to say, I expect Kamala Harris to be of higher quality because I expect her to have faced a lot more discrimination than a white man is to give short shrift to the significance of her family background and some of the strengths that she draws from it and the learning that came along with it and the identity that came along with it. It's not a, well, I'm just like a white man, but I'm just of higher quality. And I know that because I had to clear a higher hurdle.
But I think you're inverting the story a little bit. You know, we have not been saying all along that it's because women face discrimination, they are of higher quality. It's just, you know, some women happen to be of higher quality, perhaps because they had very supportive parents, very educated parents. They had, you know, great education. And only those women we are going to see actually succeeding at the top of political, you know, selection process. It's not that because she faced all these hurdles, she decided to be a better quality. She was just of a better quality because of her background, her IQ and other characteristics. And just for us, because we observe her in politics, we observe her having been successful, that's a clue for us that she's one of those. Otherwise, she wouldn't have succeeded as much as she did. Yeah, it's discrimination that made her. No, she made herself.
Yes.
But we only see her.
And she then made
the fact that we see her tells us that she made herself and she's great.
That's, there we are. And but that she making herself and her family making herself and her community making herself is itself imbued with the force of sex and race. That also bears upon the levels of discrimination that she faces and the hurdles that she has to clear. So in that sense,
yes,
right, the relevance of sex and race is not just confined to the establishment of higher hurdles. It bears upon and informs the individuals themselves who are coming forward. No? Yes.
Yes.
I want to turn from one controversial conversation to another. There is one interesting aspect of this particular presidential campaign that is unusual and it's unprecedented, which is that Joe Biden, when he was running early in the primary, he pre-announced that if he won the nomination, that his vice presidential pick would be a woman. And it was even kind of understood that it would probably be a woman of color. One interesting aspect of that is that although all women of color who have made it through the political process probably, you know, have a lot to, you know, a lot you can say about their quality and about their competence and their leadership and so on. The fact that Kamala Harris was selected as the vice presidential nomination doesn't give you a whole lot of information over and above that, because Joe Biden already had said he was going to select it. And you could even imagine Donald Trump and Trump's allies using that argument against Kamala Harris by saying, look, she wasn't actually the best person. She was just the best female, or she was just the best woman of color. And could that actually end up backfiring against her? And this is somewhat related to what Viola and Chris talked about at one point in the interview, which is, if at some point voters sort of shifted the discrimination in the other direction, if actually voters all of a sudden started preferring women, then that would actually reverse this finding, and that on net the, and so, you know, you can see how all of this plays out. Is that relevant at all? Was it, so I guess one question is, was it a mistake of Joe Biden to sort of pre-announce that he would select a woman? Because that changes this whole selection story. Will Donald Trump use this against Kamala Harris? And does this change the way we think about, you know, we think about having a female vice presidential candidate?
So I was actually about to ask a different question, which I think goes with your question very well. My question would be, why did Biden decide to select a woman? Why did he decide to announce he's going to select a woman? And why did he actually select a woman? Like,
there's no great mystery to this, right? He's a 78-year-old white man, and we start out with a pool of candidates who are all seeking the Democratic nomination who are much more diverse along both sex and racial lines, and we settle on a 78-year-old establishment white man who's going to be the head of a party that is a great deal more diverse and takes a good deal of pride in that. It was smart of him politically to commit to diversifying the ticket.
But was it? Like, after all, voters in the primaries selected an old white man, even though we had an amazing lineup of minority candidates.
Barely.
Is it really true? Like, because if it's true, then Antia Berry's story is no longer true.
I'm saying that it was good for him in the primaries, wherein he needed to signal that he got the significance of race and of gender to people who were concerned about the Democratic Party putting forward an all-white ticket. Now, how that translates into his fortunes in the general election, I think, is less clear. I mean, this is where we've got things cutting both ways. On the one hand, the Anzia Berry story carries through that, in fact, Kamala Harris is on average of higher quality by virtue of the challenges that she's faced. And I think there's discrimination in the electorate and in the political process, which will push back the other way. There will be discrimination against Kamala Harris and people who will say, you know, like, I like Biden, but, you know, he's old. And then we could have a President Harris, and I am not prepared for a woman of color to be the president of this country. And so I'm going to think twice about a Biden-Harris ticket. Those people, I don't know how many of them are, but they probably exist out there. And that's a strike against, you know, that choice.
Biden's campaign must have thought exactly about this issue. That even if you think about selecting a woman of color, it's not obvious to me that there is no gender discrimination within the black community, you know, the same way that there is within the broader society. So it, on the one hand, because she's black, she's going to bring African-American voters. But on the other hand, you know, maybe she's only going to bring female African-American voters. And female African-Americans might also have this implicit biases that everyone has against women. So he didn't have to go for a woman of color. Even after the announcement, he could have gone with Elizabeth Warren. He could have gone with some other candidate. So I think that they must have thought about all this, and they must have concluded that, you know, Kamala brings enough to the table to overcome all these issues that she's going to face. Let's see. You know, I don't know Kamala too much. You know, I haven't been following her career too much. But at least, you know, that gives me hope.
Yeah. I mean, sort of to build off of the story you just told, is that while bringing on a female vice president who is a person of color may reduce our eventual win margin, the upside is that we're going to have a person of higher caliber. And what I'm really concerned about is what life is going to look like when we govern. And I'm willing to make that trade-off.
Or I'm confident that once the public gets to know her and gets to see her during the debates and on the campaign trail from her
basement. Yeah, that can work on both levels.
They realize, well, you know, yes, maybe I don't like women or women of color, but
this one is extraordinary.
Amazing, and I have to overcome my biases or whatever I have.
Okay, so can we take another step back? I mean, I think if we take Anzia and Berry's story seriously, what it suggests is that any time that there are impediments for anybody to move forward, and that we see somebody who has the ascriptive characteristics that are being discriminated against, we see one of those people kind of persevere, we should expect them to be of higher quality. And if we take that kind of story on the road, doesn't that mean that when we are in the hospital and a male nurse comes in, and if we believe that there's a system that, and I don't know that this is true, but let's just give it to me for now, that men have a harder time becoming nurses because there's expectations that we need people to be more nurturing and there are a set of networks that privilege women. I don't know that this is true, but let's posit that that is true for the moment. That then if I see a male nurse coming in, that I should take heart in that fact because, you see, they're going against type and they've overcome the discrimination. No?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And it means that potentially we could apply the same logic to look for indirect evidence of discrimination in other settings. But it is very complicated. I think it's it's complicated for a few reasons. One is it's hard to come up with really good objective measures of performance, right? So, and maybe we can even quibble with, is co-sponsorship and distribution of federal spending, are those really good measures of performance? It could be there's even discrimination at that stage. And so maybe, you know, get less federal money for whatever reason. You might have actually said maybe that's because the male legislators are discriminating against the female, you know, and there's also multiple dimensions that we really care about. Maybe we're getting somebody, maybe if we elect a veteran, we're getting someone who really looks out for veterans, but we're getting someone who's lower quality on some other dimensions. Yes, I think all of these things make this very complicated to apply generally and even to apply in the realm of politics. But I think the story is absolutely right that we should constantly be thinking about this kind of classic selection problem of who was able to make the achievements they did conditional on the discrimination they face, and what inferences can we draw about them because of that.
And this works both ways. I mean, this is, in some instances, it's that you're going against type, or that you clearly faced, or I infer that you faced some discrimination before you entered this space, got this job, and that's going to inform my expectations about how well you're going to perform. It could also be that, no, there's some people who, you know, walk into the position. And to the extent that, I mean, you mentioned veterans, if you believe that the significance of being a veteran doesn't have any direct effect on quality, right? Like, it doesn't, by virtue of having served the country, that doesn't make me a better legislator per se.
But it could. It's possible that it could.
It's possible that it could, for sure. But that it is an advantage for me electorally, because I can say I sacrificed on behalf of our country, and that becomes a sign to voters about my commitment to country and the values that I hold. That then, if this is true, we might expect that veterans are of lower quality on average than non-veterans, because that's an advantaged ascriptive characteristic. And that's what, in that sense, again, they have a general story. It's a general story in that it carries over beyond men versus women.
I think, I just want to point out that, there's an issue that Anthony already mentioned, that it's very hard to measure quality. And also, it's not obvious which measures we should use as measure of quality. And I think what might be happening in the real world is, we have certain groups that are advantaged, and then we start conflating their behavior and their performance with success, with measure of quality. Because this is a big question that we haven't even addressed. If women indeed perform better in Congress, why isn't it that the voters learn? We've had many years over which women were in Congress, their voters should have observed that, they should have seen that they are better, and we should have already changed our attitudes. And I think the reason why voters are not learning, at least my one of the reasons, is that, again, we don't know how to measure success. We are just used to successful men, and successful men behave a certain way, and we just say that must be the measure of success, that must be the measure of quality, that must be, this person is successful, hence he must be good. Hence what I see what he's doing must be a measure of quality. And I see this woman and she's not behaving the same way. And I'm saying, well, perhaps she's not of high quality.
For sure. And we make the wrong inferences. I mean, the lesson of this paper is we make the wrong inferences in lots of ways. And we seem to.
There's some evidence. One relevant piece of evidence is that voters appear to update their beliefs about female candidates. So Ferrer and Gyurko have this paper about female mayors, and their finding is that the sophomore surge, which is essentially just the number of votes you get the second time you run for election compared to the first time that you won, women have higher sophomore surges than male candidates do, so which is consistent with the story. Maybe there's other explanations for that as well, but it could be that voters initially are, for whatever reason, skeptical or discriminatory against women, but then once they elect them, they realize, actually, this person's a pretty good mayor, and they vote for them, they could increase their votes for them more than they would for a male candidate.
But they don't seem to update about women in general. They seem
but
to
the
update,
next woman, yeah, that's right, that's yeah, right. The is, next woman is, that comes along, right.
Which is a little bit strange, which might be consistent with the story I was trying to say, that, I see I'm actually having a pretty good life under this mayor, so she must be a good mayor. But when I'm evaluating the next woman, I don't have experience with living under this woman as a mayor, so I'm looking at the measures of quality that I'm used to, which is how do you speak? Are you loud? Are you super confident in the opinions that you express? And do you see the world in black and white? And then again, I fall back on my biases that, I've developed, that most of the people that I've seen that were successful were actually extremely eloquent, and they spoke in black and white, and they spoke over other people. Well, and then I draw my conclusions.
So what's your bottom line?
All right, my bottom line is, I like this paper a lot. I think it presents really interesting evidence on a question that is very hard to study directly, right? You can't just go field a survey and ask people if they're discriminatory towards women. You're not going to get very reliable answers from that. Either they won't tell you the truth, or maybe they don't even know themselves. And so they're coming up with a very clever way to study a very challenging question. And so I come away sort of convinced by the story, and I come away looking for, you know, more signs of it and more ways to think about it in the context of modern American politics. Count me in favor of this paper.
So I also like the paper a lot. First of all, it shows us that women in politics do quite well, perform quite well. And I didn't have any prior. I didn't really know of papers who carefully study how women do. And I think this is going to be news to a lot of people. So I think that's already a great contribution. And I also think that I buy their explanation for that. And although we, as we mentioned, there might be a lot of other things that are going on, women might face networking hurdles, they might face higher costs. But at the end of the day, I think they made a pretty compelling argument that those two stories of discrimination and selection seem to be needed to reconcile all the findings from their paper and some other papers. And those findings are very robust. So I think it gives us, you know, a pretty robust way to think about why we have so few women and what we should see moving forward.
All right, so we're 3 for 3. I mean, it's a terrific paper, right? It's a terrific... We didn't talk much about their research design, but they have a really, you know, kind of a compelling research design to back out what the relevance is of electing at the margin a man versus a woman to Congress. What kinds of expectations flow in terms of their performance in office? You know, there are lots of ways of measuring quality and performance and success, and they put forward some, and the ones that they do seem solid. The last thing I'll say is that it does a remarkable job of underscoring the significance of discrimination for political outcomes without ever directly measuring discrimination. They don't have data on this. And yet they have a set of findings, as Viola points out, that can only be or primarily be, I mean, the best available explanations point towards discrimination for trying to make sense of the pattern of findings that they put forward. Thanks for listening to Not Another Politics Podcast.
Our show is a podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy and is produced by Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening.